You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome, travelers. We're aware that your journey was difficult, but prepare to have your questions answered, for you have been granted an audience with the Masters of Modern.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Masters of Modern. I am here with my co-host, Glenn Jones.
Hello, everyone. How's it going?
And Jimmy Wong.
Special guest. What's up?
So today we're going to be talking about Modern Masters 2. We're going to be doing some speculating on what that is possible. We think it's coming soon to you guys and to us, and so we want to have a little conversation about it.
Coming to an LGS near you.
Yeah.
Could be.
And then we're going to end it up with a deck tech. Today's deck tech is going to be on Blue, White, Red, Control for Modern.
Ooh. One of my favorite archetypes.
Oh, yeah. I've played that archetype in more PTQs and GPs than I think.
I can tell by how worn out your sleeves are that you play that one the most.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I need to change those before I go to another tournament with it. But, all right, so let's kind of get into it.
Well, before we dive into Modern Masters 2, I think we should probably give a little loose idea of what Modern Masters 1 was.
Right, as
an intro.
Best booster pack to open ever.
Right. Certainly up there.
I don't think in the history of packs I've ever, like, felt more comfortable opening a pack than Modern Masters 1.
Right, just for straight value potential, yeah.
I don't think I ever lost money opening a pack.
It was a good trip down nostalgia lane, too. So Modern Masters 1 was a reprint set. It was also priced a little up there because it was a limited print run, which meant there was not as much of it around.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a reprint set specifically for Modern. It was focusing on cards that are played in the format, cards that are maybe too expensive, or cards that are especially interesting, and kind of driving their price down, making the format more available and accessible. And it really worked in that regard.
Right. And we talked about this in previous episodes, but you know, the reason that Modern was created is so that they can kind of allow for the prices of the format to be a little lower because they can reprint cards in the format.
Mm-hmm.
And so Modern Masters was the original, hey, look, we're completely willing to do this. Check it out.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, the set. And they kind of did a good job. And they were, you know, one of the worries was that it would be similar to the older set that was printed that was also a giant reprint, which was
Chronicles.
And Chronicles kind of decimated the card market. And it was really the reason that the reserve list was originally created. And so they didn't want to kind of make the exact same mistake. So they did. They were really, really, really tentative about, you know, printing too much of the format, which also made it really expensive. But what it did do is kind of it enough people got it into the format and got excited because of it that it kind of blew up Modern as a format in general.
Yeah, we talked about Tarmogoyf specifically last episode as an example. And it was a card that, you know, was very high priced before Modern Masters came out, got reprinted, and its price only ballooned from there.
Yeah.
Because so many more people were playing the format thanks to the accessibility created by the Modern Master set. So really a masterstroke from Wizards marketing in this regard.
I mean, what it comes down to, if I own a Tarmogoyf in a Modern Masters pack, I now need to get four of them because I'm going to want to play that card that I just opened. So it really encourages more people to actually want Tarmogoyfs than it did to hinder the need for them.
Yeah.
Beyond that, you know, it's something we're going to go into today is kind of what Modern Masters 1 was also.
Well, for a brand new player, if you opened it, every single booster pack had a guaranteed foil in it instead of sort of the reserve spot for a land.
Right.
Also, it just had money cards in it. Tarmogoyf, obviously, Dark Confidant, Vendilion Click, just a lot of like super awesome mythic rares and just rares across the board, like staples that you would want to either potentially open a foil for or just like couldn't have access to because a lot of these cards are pretty hard to get in general. Like, when are you going to open the Tarmogoyf in a future site pack? Mm-hmm. Like, you're not going to get that.
Right.
Yeah. Outside of even just that, like, the cards are, you know, literally mythic in a regard. Like, not just mythic rares, but they're the kind of cards that you hear about or that articles constantly mention or compare other cards to. So getting, like, a direct hands-on experience with these older, really powerful cards is really cool. And a limited format is also a place that kind of balances them out so people can enjoy them without, you know, needing to be super invested. And I think Modern Masters limited format, which is the biggest way it really differentiated from a set like Chronicles, owes a lot to that because it was a very draftable set. It was constructed specifically for that purpose. And I think that that's actually like the majority of the enjoyment was derived from that format. I know it's one of my favorite limited formats of all time. I think, easily my top five.
I think collectively, like, it's agreed Modern Masters 1 is one of the top draft formats ever created.
Yeah.
I think it's up there with Innistrad, Triple Innistrad and Rise of the Eldrazi and Original Ravnica, where these sets that, like, the the depth of what you can do in the format, like, go anywhere from doing the archetypes that they built, and we'll go into some of the archetypes they built, to completely new things of, like, Storm with all of the colors, or Domain Dredge, or these, you know, multiple archetypes mushing together into these super powerful, kind of really fun decks to play. And they're built around, because it's all about nostalgia, because it's about cards that existed already, there's less of a need to kind of figure out how to balance new cards for Standard, and it's more about let's go balls to the walls and do the best that we possibly can.
Yeah, and almost every single card, even if it was like the last pick in the pack, was playable, which is pretty rare. Like, I whenever I drafted, it'd be like the 12th, 13th pick, I'd be like, I could definitely play this.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's the kind power of level something they decided to do with the format, is they decided to, you know, some of the color archetypes, some of the two color, so each two color archetype had a different draft strategy built into it. And when you do that, it allows for some cards to be like, well, if I'm playing Rebels, I want every Rebels cards, but if no one else is playing it, they don't want them. The Rebels are just completely useless.
Right, they're garbage otherwise.
So they're not going to be high picking them, so I have a chance later picks to get them. Same with the Affinity decks, where, like, there's you know, one cost artifacts with modular 1/1s that no one wants, but for my deck are great, and so I'm going to be able to pick those up later, making it so my draft archetypes are going to work a little bit better.
Yeah, I think that really when people ask me to describe the nature of the format and how it's constructed, I compare it to like Ravnica or Return to Ravnica, which had, you know, these strategy specific two color pairs going on across the set, and also Cube, where you have that density of playables. You know, you're not wheeling cards that are just bad.
Right.
Everything's like pretty reasonable. Yeah. And there are all these very powerful cards from Magic's history. So it kind of has a feel of both of those things going on. And those are, you know, two of my favorite formats as well. So it made the format very attractive.
Well, and you know, this kind of draft format construction, it really lends itself to people deciding ahead of time what they want to do and being able to kind of like stick with the game plan and go for it. And that's often more often than time when draft formats are the most rewarding.
Ah, yes. That's true. Yeah, because someone to the right of you could be drafting the same colors as you, and you guys will never pick the same cards.
Right. You're always drafting a deck and not a pile of cards, which is, that I find is a very rewarding
experience. Right, right.
Yeah, so you want to get to the end of the draft and be like, this is cool. I built something.
Yeah, right. I built synergy.
Like, it's not like, M15 or limited drafts, for especially core sets, have always been like, good stuff, try to have a curve, where this was definitely much more of a, like, there's a plan. I'm going to do Storm. I'm not going to do I will have no creatures. All my spells are going to be about chaining spells and getting a giant goblin army to kind of swing to and attack my opponent.
And Modern Masters was obviously one of the most popular draft formats of all time. We've said that, and it was, you know, really kind of hammered home by the Modern Masters Grand Prix in Las Vegas.
Right, which is still the largest GP of all time.
Still the record holder for largest GP of all time. It capped at 4,500. I think they had less than that actually playing come round one, because a lot of people opened their Tarmogoyf and said sayonara.
Right,
yeah.
But definitely one of certainly the largest Magic tournament that, you know, has ever been held.
Right.
And it's probably not getting topped anytime, especially soon.
Yeah, no. I mean, what it comes down to, and we'll go into this a little bit, but it looks like there's going to be multiple Modern Masters, two GPs, if it is happening when we think it's going to happen.
Right.
So the reason that this one was so big was it was really the only one that I know of. And on top of that, it was in Las Vegas, which happens to be this very easy destination city that the city itself subsidizes flights to the city. So it's much easier to get to than most other places.
And Wizards had steered clear of Las Vegas for a really long time. They'd held Grand Prix there before. In fact, when I was in middle school, I won a Grand Prix trial for Las Vegas.
Oh, nice.
So that's about how long ago it was.
Right.
Considering a lot of pro Magic players are also poker players, I find that surprising. But
that's the association they kind of don't want. So they'd steered clear for a while, but eventually, and I think part of it was the SCG Open Series started going to Vegas, and those tournaments were very well-run and successful, and they didn't have any issues. And I think that kind of created okayed it with the community at large and created this positive impression, and I'm happy for that. So they went to Vegas, had this gigantic tournament, and now one of the reasons we think Modern Masters 2 is pretty likely is, you know, we have these GPs on the schedule that don't have a format announced coming around summertime.
May 30th. So May 30th, they announced the GP schedule at the Pro Tour for M15, and there are three unnamed, mystery location GPs on May 30th, all limited format. And the other interesting factor is that they actually moved up set releases for the winter and spring sets. So instead of normally what is now Fate Reforged coming out in February 3rd, February 4th. It is now coming out middle of January. And
right.
the set that normally comes out in May is now coming out in April, March. And so this huge move of formats, plus the fact that there's these weird mystery GPs that are existing, and they pointed them out as mystery GPs during the the broadcast of the Pro Tour, leads a lot of people to believe that Modern Master 2 is on the horizon.
I do want to add that there are also three Modern GPs following up in the summer. So that kind of also maybe incentivizes, hey, people are going to be thinking about this format. I wonder why that would be.
Right.
And I think that running three GPs like that, really close, the potential Modern Masters 2 GPs, is an interesting way to try and fight off that 4,500 player tournament as well.
Right.
Because, you know, you've
got
three events cannibalizing each other. People flew in from Europe to play in GP Las Vegas. So, you know, you put one over there, maybe people don't do something that crazy.
Right. Well, and I mean, they didn't have enough judges in the Northern Hemisphere to do GP Vegas. They had to fly people in from, like, many other countries just to be able to handle the amount of players. It was almost unsustainable.
I think that it was unsustainable. I think that nobody wants that tournament to happen again.
Right.
Really.
4,500.
Even the people counting the money at the end of the day are just like, that was maybe not worth it.
Right.
Yeah.
So before we get into the Modern Masters 2, we want to kind of go through the deck archetypes for Modern Masters 1 and explain, you know, what those were, so that when we get to Modern Masters 2, we can go and talk about, because one of the things we're going to do is go into what we think the different deck archetypes or two color combinations will
might be
in the future. So blue-white is Affinity.
Right.
So it's an artifact. We kind of explained what the deck does in the first episode of the podcast, but it's all about getting as many artifacts on the board and
key
all
cards.
The cards. Key cards have synergies with each other.
Ethereum Sculptor makes every artifact cost one less.
Arcbound Ravager. There's synergy with, they actually are using a lot of the actual mechanics from Mirrodin Block, which, you know, the deck no longer actually does. So they have a lot of modular cards, a lot of low-cost artifacts. They're playing all of the actual, like, free affinity cards. So they have Frogmite and
Mirror Enforcer.
So, like, you know, Mirror Enforcer is a card that it's 7 to play it normally, but with Affinity, it's a free 4/4 eventually.
Right.
And so, it's, you know, the deck can power out these really cheap costed artifacts really quickly.
What they really did, and it was kind of smart, was they pilfered Affinity from both the original of Affinity sets, the Mirrodin Block, and also Shards of Alara with the Esper cards.
Right.
Because the issue with Affinity, and it was an issue that obviously affected Constructed, was, you know, Affinity in Mirrodin Block was all about playing creatures really cheaply and quickly, and that was it. That was like your whole focus, was just swarming the board.
Right.
Whereas Shards of Alara had Esper, which was artifact focused, but it was like you get paid for playing with artifacts, not all of your cards don't cost anything anymore or whatever.
Right.
So by merging those two things together, they created a really cool deck. You know, you didn't need artifact lands like you did in Mirrodin Block. Instead, you had things like Fairy Mechanist or Sanctum Gargoyle. Fairy Mechanist impulses for an artifact, and Sanctum Gargoyle brings them back from the grave. So these cards pay you for playing with a deck that's completely filled with artifacts by giving you a lot of value and ways to reuse your best cards. And that's exactly how the deck kind of formed. Instead of being the Swarm-style deck, it was all about accruing value, getting a lot of synergy going. And Esperzo, as I mentioned before, a 2 and a blue for a 4-3 flyer that lets you return an artifact to your hand every turn.
Right.
And I say lets you. That's not a drawback.
Things
like Fairy Mechanist and Sanctum Gargoyle.
Right. The next archetype we're going to go into is Rebels, which is the white-black draft archetype. Rebels are a creature type that, you know, classically, they're originally from Mercadian Mask Box, but then they were reprinted in Time Spiral Block. And what they do is they're, you know, low-cost efficient creatures that can then tap for 4 mana to search for the next level of converted mana cost. So in Modern Masters, most of them were 2 drops that searched for 3-drop Rebel cards. And there happened to be a lot of very powerful 3-drop Rebel, well, not necessarily powerful, but very value-oriented 3-drop Rebel cards.
It was a smart shift in Modern Masters because originally, in Mercadian Mass, Rebels were printed with, they were against Mercenaries, which were a black thing tribe that was very similar, but Mercenaries searched for creatures cheaper than themselves by one, and Rebels searched for creatures more expensive than themselves by one. Naturally, it's pretty easy to see which of those is going to be better, because nobody wants to make their board worse at the cost of an increase in mana. So by shifting the Rebels down and not including that huge emphasis on searching and being able to chain your way all the way up into 6 drops for free, essentially, they managed to create a format that was more about creatures and value and less about, like, oh, my deck is busted.
Right. Well, and it kind of worked well with the, because Modern Masters 1 had such a high tribal component in the deck, it used a mechanic that belongs to Shapeshifters from Lorwyn block, which allow these are cards that have every creature type.
Changelings.
And it's based off of a legendary called Misform Elemental, which is just that. He just has the original creature that was all creature types.
Misform Ultimus.
Misform Ultimus. And
these are some of my favorite cards in the set, too, because they work for all the tribal
decks. They're really like, they're the role players of the format. Because
they're the glue, for sure. They tie everything.
Right. And almost every deck, you almost pick them really highly because almost every deck is interested in them. And, you know, there's a 2-2 flyer. A lot of them have evasion. There's
the red guy that pumps War Spike Changing.
First strike.
Yeah.
So Bull Giant that gains first strike. Very good.
You know, these cards are the glue held together. So it allows rebels to kind of, and a lot of them are 3-drops. So it lets rebels search them out. It lets some of the other archetypes, giants, fairies, goblins, to kind of do
cheaper
things
or whatever
that they want.
It also keeps the set size down, you know, because when you have a bunch of different tribes crossing into, you know, obviously you're sharing tribal colors with a lot of these guys, a changeling goes into both decks. Like, you know, the white-red, which we're going to get to soon, giants, they can share avian changeling with rebels. You don't need to print a giant and a rebel in that kind of slot.
Makes them a little bit more value, too, especially because in the Giants deck, you don't really have many flyers, so the Avian Changeling is pretty important.
What it winds up meaning is that you often have to take Changelings higher than the cards you want. For example, you know, maybe a Saltfield Recluse might be more important to your Rebel deck because he's a Rebel you can search out, but an Avian Changeling, you're never going to see that on the wheel, so you may want to go for the Changeling.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay, after Rebels is Giants, which is a much more straightforward. You play a lot of Giants. There are cards that are lower cost that either make Giants cheaper or will, you know, get bonuses for having Giants. And
some cards can't even attack or block without Giants out, but are very cheap otherwise.
Right. Mm-hmm. The best blind spot, the really important Giant card,
Thundercloud Shaman,
which
hits the board and does damage to every non-giant creature equal to the number of giants you control.
Right.
Essentially a board wipe. If you have like five giants out, you're going to destroy the board.
Right. It's really the big motivating force for why you play that format. So you're playing this card so that you can literally play it and win pretty much that same turn.
Yeah, swing in for the...
I think giants, interestingly, were one of the archetypes that remained the least changed from the last time we saw them. And I think part of that is, you know, there haven't been a lot of giant-themed tribal sets.
Right.
So Lorwyn block had pretty much all of the giants that we saw come around this time already.
Right.
Which, you know, included the Blindspot Giant, which we already talked about, 3-mana, 4/3. Mm-hmm. Thundercloud Shaman, obviously. The Changelings are, in fact, from Lorwyn block originally.
Right.
And even Kithkin Greatheart, which is the white card that kind of pairs you into white alongside all those giants, is a Kithkin from Lorwyn block originally, and he gets boosted.
So to go through the next... I'm going to just finish off all the tribal. Goblins, which was red-black.
Right.
This is a format that I actually personally think wasn't as consistent at actually being pulled off as something like Rebels or Giants was. Because I don't think... Partly, and it very well could be this, is that they actually didn't include the black changeling. They included the blue one, which was there for fairies. But fairies... There was no other blue tribal card, but there was a black one. So it was weird that this specific color combination didn't really get a secondary changeling that kind of let it kind of have a much deeper card pool available to them, along with the fact that I think this format didn't really lend itself to non-super synergetic aggro situations when, you know, affinity is beating you down and these other things are just valuing out. Goblins, where it's like, you're just going to attack you, doesn't really work as well as they probably wanted.
Yeah.
I liked Goblins a fair bit. It was one of the archetypes I enjoyed drafting, although I'd often splice it into other decks because Warren Pilferers, which was probably the largest incentive to be Goblins, is essentially a Gravedigger for Goblins.
Right.
And get a Gravedigger for anything, but gains haste when you Gravedigger a Goblin.
Yeah, and Mad Auntie, too, that gives everyone plus one, every Goblin plus one you can regenerate.
Yeah, and regenerates. Also very strong. So there were definitely incentives to be in there, and it is kind of interesting that they didn't get a Changeling, but the archetype... Yeah. Again, you know, they really paid homage to Lorwyn with it. It functioned very similarly to how goblins functioned back then.
Yeah.
So, you know, nothing too crazy. I think that Tar Pitcher became pretty good in this set, in contrast to Lorwyn block, where it was fine. But in this set, when you had to fight off all those flyers from Affinity, you really kind of wanted to be able to throw your guys and shock things around.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I'd say definitely the biggest problem with goblins is that there's just so many other bigger bodies that can very... often advantageously face off against the goblins. You like get the wrong matchup, or they just fly over your head.
Yeah, you could definitely get stunted by the Thalids in green, or by, you know, Saltfield Recluse from the Rebel deck, and it would make it kind of difficult to get in there in combat.
Right.
Which is one of the reasons I really liked Tar Pitcher, because it kind of let you break up those situations.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So there's two more tribal decks left in Modern Masters 2. The next is Fairies, which is the blue-black draft archetype. Fairies is very much, you know, it's similar to the original one. It is, has less of a focus on Flash than I think the original time it was in Lorwyn.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Though it does have cards like Pestermite and Spellstarter's Blight, which Pestermite is a constructed all-star, where what it does is it comes to play, it can untap or tap another target permanent.
Right.
This normally combos with Kiki Jiki, which happens in Modern Masters 1 on occasion. But... you know, it more often it's just a really, like, it's a strong Flash 2-1 flyer that, you know, comes down and has an effect. The other major Flash card is Spellstarter Sprite, which counters his target spell equal to converted mana cost less than how many fairies you control.
The terror of Lorwyn Ear standard conjunction of Bitter Blossom.
Not to mention he can flash him in. So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a Flash 1-1, and every time you get value by countering a spell, that's huge.
Right,
yeah.
And
you get
the
body.
Flyer is, you know, not to be underestimated. You only have 20 life. I don't know if you guys know. But.
Yeah. Well, soon that will be 19, then 18, 17.
Yeah.
Other cards that are important, like Marsh Flitter, which was kind of just a big body on the ground,
very
face.
Powerful. It also had some crossover with that goblin,
right? Yeah, yeah. And you know, this is also one of the archetypes that weirdly had a lot of support at the rare and mythic level. So there was a lot more reasons to be pushed into this format based off of the packs you open.
Right.
They had things like Vendilion Click, which was mythic. They had Scion of Una. They had Una, Queen of the Fae. They had Glenelunda, Archmage. Which some of these cards are good in general, but they also are putting you in blue
and
contributing to this tribe. So there's a more likely that you'd open a pack and be like, oh, I got Scion of Una. I'm just going to draft all the fairies versus other tribal decks where it was much more of an uncommon and common game.
Yeah,
right.
And then I guess the last of the tribal decks, which is probably the least tribally is the word I'm going to use.
Domain.
Which is the, fungus, tokens,
phthalids. Yeah,
phthalids.
Yeah.
And more because they have this weird double tribe where they're really a sapperling tribal deck, but all of their creatures that you're casting are phthalids.
Right, and the basic idea of phthalids is put spore counters on phthalids. At a certain number of spore counters, they pop off and become 1/1 little sapperling.
Right.
Yep.
And when Masters came out, I was like, oh, I was really excited that I get to play with this archetype. That like,
right.
And classically, it's not very good because it's all about having a giant board presence, and one player plays a board wipe, and you're just out of the game.
Yeah. Also, it's about keeping your creatures in play, which generally, if you can do that, you're in good shape anyway.
Yeah, you're going to be winning anyway, yeah.
So it's a weird archetype that, like, so what it ended up being is more that these phthalids played more role players for other archetypes a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. And part of the thing that kept it, you know, somewhat strong is that green... one of Green's main mechanics in this set was Domain, and so its entire motivation is to get a lot of colors, so it made it really easy to splash off of green-white.
Right.
To, like, really play a different game plan that just had some value engines that are just built into what you were doing.
Yeah, you really wound up playing the Phthalids more because they were just, like, reasonable bodies. Like, mm-hmm. Phthalid Germinator is a 3-mana 2/2 that every now and then gives you a +1/+1 at instant speed. That's handy.
Right,
right.
The Spore Sword Phthalid, 4-mana 4/4 that every now and then is making some 1/1s also helps other Phthalids.
Right, yeah.
That's also handy. And they really pulled from the Time Spiral revisitation to Phthalids in this, but they removed the thing that essentially, you know, paid you off the most, which was Sprout Swarm, which was like the least fun limited experience of all time,
Just
filling the board with tokens. But in doing so, they definitely made Phthalids more of a traditional creature curve style deck that just occasionally generated value, as opposed to, you know, you compare it to the tribe like Rebels, which is like, my card gets value. That's what it does.
Right.
That's
like
what it's
direct
for.
Right.
Yeah.
So now that we're done with all the tribal, I just mentioned it, Domain, which was originally meant to be the blue-green archetype, but the thing with Domain is that
you want to have as many basic land types
as possible.
It's not a
specific color archetype. It's really the let's splash as many colors as possible and really get down in there.
So Domain rewards you for having different basic land types. One of the biggest cards is like Tromp the Domains, where you creatures get +1/+1 for every basic land type you control, which is just like a huge overwhelm if you have five basic lands out. That's like +5/+5 across the board.
Right.
You're gonna win every matchup in that case if you can get that off. Also, it paired really well with Sunburst, which was a big, just basically creatures come into play with more counters based on how many basic land types you use to play it, or I mean how much different mana, not basic land types in this case.
All Star being Etched Oracle, who you know is a four cost thing where if it has four counters on it, you can remove four counters. It's an artifact, and you draw four cards, and
you draw three cards.
Oh yeah,
but it's also target player.
Yeah,
some of us at the table have been known to deck the occasional opponent with Etched Oracle. Also, some of us at the table have been known to not be able to deck the opponent because Sunburst was bugged on Magic Online.
Ooh,
so
that seems like one of those things that just it makes sense. It was bugged on Modo.
So you know the deck is all about getting as many colors as possible. It has some of the more efficient removal if you can pull it off
with
Tribal Flame, Drag Down. Tribal Flames in general can also just outright kill a player real quick, because it ends up that 5 damage to a person's face for 2 mana is very strong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I've heard.
And this archetype was supplemented pretty interestingly, actually, by the Vivid Lands.
Yeah.
Which Vivid Lands really pay you off for, you know, wanting to splash other colors. They help you out in that regard. But they also don't actually help you with Domain. So it's kind of like a very strange tension going on there.
They help you with Sunburst, but not Domain.
Right.
Which is interesting. So... But they're great lands. They just come into play tap with 2 charge counters on it, and you can tap to if it's a certain color, or you can tap to remove a charge counter for any color.
Yeah, every limited format needs some kind of form of mana fixing, and in this regard, they chose to go for a land that isn't widely played in the modern format. Instead, it's just like this is a limited oriented only kind of thing, and it worked the last time, so why not?
And and they saw standard play. I mean, they've seen premier play
before.
Yeah, they're
not terrible cards.
They're just in modern, the mana fixing is just. Yeah. Above and beyond the level that they become.
You would never want to draw a land on turn 9 that's going to come into play tapped.
You would never want to draw a land on turn 9 at all.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Well, yeah,
precisely.
Other than Celestial Colonnade, my good friend.
Yeah, right. Maybe an Inkmoth Nexus.
So the next archetype is the green-black one, which is the Dredge archetype.
So Dredge is one of the more broken mechanics in Magic, because it actually allows you to control your draw step, which is obviously the most random element in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So Dredge, when a card is in your graveyard and has the Dredge ability, you can, instead of drawing that card, dredge whatever number it has, which puts that number of cards from your library into your graveyard, and then you return that card to your hand. So, for example, the primary offender, Golgari Grave Troll, he's a giant troll. Right. He has Dredge 6. Instead of drawing a card, you can simply return him to your hand and mill 6 cards from your library.
He's banned in Modern.
He is banned in Modern for no gosh darn reason. Nobody would do anything.
Right. The thing you'll need to learn is most people at this table love the Dredge mechanic to some extent and would love to play with
I'm a graveyard fanatic. I love to get value out of the graveyard. So it's a big deal for me.
Well, it's like you get to see your deck and you're using your graveyard as your deck. And it's like, what better to see? Like, look, all these cards I can see face up, and I can choose which one I want and return them? Amazing.
Well, and the reason they're banned is because in Eternal Legacy formats and Vintage, they use them in much more of a combo I can win before the third turn kind of way that's very linear and not played in a way that's really fun to play against. But in Modern, if they were legal, it wouldn't be played in a similar way because the cards that make that engine kind of work aren't available. It'd be a much more grindier, and the decks that exist are much more grindier and much more about gaining incremental value off of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason Dredge was broken was they printed a card that's not a Magic card.
Right.
From
right.
So that's the real reason. But anyway, in this set, Dredge has the second best dredger available, Stinkweed Imp,
right.
Which is a 1/2 flyer that has essentially Death Touch, not quite. It's kind of weird. Right.
It feels like it's 5. Old wording on it.
It
almost,
is,
yeah.
So he's obviously pretty handy, and he's a reasonable creature in and of himself, especially because flying is pretty important in the limited format.
He's probably one of the best defensive creatures also in the format.
Yeah.
If you're not doing the dredge plan, but you just need a big wall in the way of people attacking
you. Yeah, he gets in the
way
of something like Esperzoa. That's a big deal.
And I would argue they actually have the third best dredge card as well, which is Light from the Loam, which is the best card for completely different reasons.
It does some interesting things. In this particular world, Dredge, you don't get paid the way you did before, which was essentially with a lot of things like Unearth and Reanimating or whatever. Instead, you get paid for the cards that you draw, which actually creates a really weird tension because you have to get the card that's good with Dredge and then stop drawing cards. So if you're just dredging, you're not necessarily going to be set up, with the exception of Worm Harvest, which is a retrace card, meaning you can cast it from your graveyard by discarding a land. Functions pretty excellently alongside Life from the Loam. You can just kind of start fueling Worm Harvest, making a bunch of 1/1s.
Right.
The other big payoff is Tombstalker. 5/5 flyer for 8 mana, but you can delve, which involves exiling cards from the graveyard in order to cheapen them up.
Which you all know about now, because it's now currently in Standard, I think, by the time this episode releases.
Maybe, yeah.
Delve, there were originally only 3 cards with Delve printed, and Tombstalker is the kind of the big baddie, the one that everyone kind of knows about. And that's one of the rares that kind of puts you in this format. And Dredge, there actually ends up being a few rares that also kind of lead you into other colors. And as we talked about, because green is so much about fixing in this set sometimes, it makes it kind of easy to accomplish. So like Knight of the Reliquary, which normally is just a value aggro card, just like a good searching lands. But when you're dredging 5 lands every turn or a couple lands into your graveyard, like just out of value, playing a 3-drop that ends up being a 10-10, straight out the bat, seems to be pretty powerful.
And
among that, Academy Ruins, which is another land that allows you to take artifacts from your graveyard and put them on top of your library. So if you mill these important artifacts, you can get them back.
Yeah, everyone knows about Dredge Affinity.
Right. Well, if you're playing all the color, all the colors, Etched Oracle comes in and starts drawing lots of cards or milling lots of cards.
Yeah, and the Academy Runes keeps you from decking in that particular archetype, which is handy. One of the weaknesses to Dredge, I think, in the format was you really wanted one of those rares, or generally multiple of those rares, to get paid for playing in the first place. So people didn't usually strive to get into the archetype.
Right.
Quote unquote archetype. Because it really was kind of a splashy kind of thing.
Right, exactly. And I think the only time I ever played it religiously or like fully was at GP Vegas. Mm-hmm. And it's because I had Life from the Loam, Academy of Ruins, Night of the Reliquary, Worm Harvest, all of the Dredgers. Like, it was the deck was made for me. I was like, I'm just going to win all these matches.
We did leave off one of the big payoffs for Dredge, which is Hirobi's Whisper. We mentioned it earlier. And it's an arcane spell. So you can splice it, but its splice cost involves exiling cards from the graveyard, four specifically. So it really pairs pretty nicely with Dredge in that regard, because you know you can get a few arcane spells, and you can just start playing additional Dark Banishings every turn.
Right.
You do have to have a swamp, so it does require you to commit actually to playing black. You
can't just put it in your blue-red deck.
Right.
Yeah, but like you could otherwise, you know, really have like just a blue-red deck with Glacial Rays and Reach Through Mist or whatever, and just every time you got four cards in the graveyard, thunk.
Here comes Hirobi's Whisper.
Right.
Now, speaking of blue-red, I guess we should go into Storm.
Right. I think there's only really two more archetypes left, and it's Storm and Storm.
Yeah.
Which is, what they did is interesting. They actually tried putting Storm in red-green, but it ends up because blue-red just is the colors that are Storm, and you can't really fight it. And because the archetype they put in the blue-red was spliced onto Arcane, which kind of leads itself to playing a lot of spells in a single turn anyways, it ended up just being kind of a combination of blue-red-green.
I think it was kind of a deliberate hybridization. I don't think anyone was thinking, no, these Reach Through Mist Glacial Ray decks are definitely going to be all about that. Nobody's going to try and cast Empty the Warrants.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's the voice Wizards has at all
times. Yeah, exactly. And Storm, for you guys that don't know, is just a basic mechanic where you can double or copy a spell for every extra spell you've cast that turn.
Yes. So it pays you off for generating a critical mass, pays you off for drawing a lot of cards. These are all things that people love to do.
Right.
Yeah.
And it actually, it's one of the most powerful mechanics ever printed. Wizards of the Coast has a scale that is named after the mechanic Storm of the things that are most likely to be reprinted back in the standard.
Yeah.
And the number 10, the second the least likely thing to ever come back to standard is Storm.
Is Storm,
The number one is, which is a joking 11, is Bands with Legends or something like that.
I'm pretty sure I can guess that one.
Yeah. Well, it's also just, it makes turns can take a long time because it's a lot of math.
Right.
It's a very sort of one side of the fair when someone's trying to figure out how to storm their way.
Yeah, it's not a fun experience because it's one player playing Magic while the other one waits.
Right.
That's not good.
Yeah, to see if he can get it to, I guess, finish the Storm combo and get, and in this case, Empty the Warrens, get, 40 goblins on the battlefield.
The two main Storm cards in the set, and there's technically a third, but Grape Shot, which is do one damage, Storm. So for two mana, you can, no matter how many spells you played, you get a burn spell that does that much damage.
Right.
And then Empty the Warrants, which you get two goblin tokens for how many spells you played. And this is generally your main win condition, because if you can pull off an Empty the Warrens, they either have to wipe the board the next turn or they're probably not winning.
And it's worth pointing out that Grape Shot is modern powerful. Like, it's good enough to see tier one play in modern. And Empty the Warrens is good enough to see tier one play in modern and legacy. So these are powerful cards.
Yeah.
Obviously, in limited, you're not going to have access to a lot of the things like, Desperate Ritual or Manamorphose or. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, no, those cards are in this set.
They're all here.
Technically, I'll bring it up. There is a third Storm card, and it's Dragon Storm. It is a rare, and it costs 9 mana.
Yeah, that's
and
not happening.
What it lets you do is it gets you put any a dragon from your deck into play for free for how many Storm you have. Yeah. So it doesn't really happen in the set because I think there's only 5 Mythic Rare Dragons.
There are 5 Mythic Rare Dragons. However, I have completed the Dragonstorm checkpoint, which is Dragonstorm for 2 dragons.
Nice.
So that Storm deck was kind of entertaining, but not something you want to necessarily
strive
pursue
for.
Frequently. Yeah,
exactly.
So yeah, that's kind of the main archetypes for what Modern Masters 1 was. So I guess now it's time to get into Modern Masters 2 and some of our predictions. Most likely in the future, we'll be probably doing a few more Modern Masters podcasts. This is going to be your introductory one, which is why we've gone so deep into Modern Masters 1, kind of like remind of the history.
And you really want to be able to say, I called it.
Oh, yeah. I really just want to be like, I called it Modern Masters 2 coming out this May 30th, 3 GPs. Modern Masters, get ready for it.
Well, I will see you there then, in that case, Alex.
So... The the main thing I guess we want to talk about, and the thing you guys are probably most interested in, is which rares we think are going to be in the set.
Right. And that means which sets are going to be reprinted.
Right. So, yeah, I guess the first thing we want to talk about is so the original Modern Masters was every set from 8th edition up till Shards of Alara block.
Mm-hmm.
So that means everything from that point wasn't in there. And since it's been 2 years, the thought is that they're going to increase the barrier of what sets. And one of the reasons they think that's also, or we think that's also going to happen, is that by moving it up 2 years, it opens up archetypes that weren't originally in the Modern Masters.
Yes.
And allows mm-hmm. for a lot more cards. And it'll be maybe a little bit more weighted to those two formats or three formats that they're going to introduce. Those sets are possibly, or blocks are Zendikar block, Scars of Mirrodin block, and possibly Innistrad block.
Yeah, I think that it seems pretty inevitable for two reasons, which you touched on. One is, like, a lot of the cards from those sets just are expensive, and
right.
you want to be
yeah.
able to reprint them. And another reason is the limited format. You know, how many times can you, you know, redo
right.
Modern through just the lens of that kind of tiny window? And I think that the limited format for Modern, they like to pull things that were popular in their respective limited formats in, and that's what they're looking to do with Modern Masters. So
right.
you definitely want to move back. And I think Innistrad especially has one of the most popular, a few of the most popular things
right.
to do in limited of all time, which, you know, has this graveyard-oriented, flashback-oriented kind of theme going on.
Mm-hmm.
I think they would love to play with that again.
Right. I mean, what it really comes down to, if all you're adding is the two sets, you're really just adding a standard season
mm-hmm.
to the format. If you're adding three, you're actually increasing the card
yeah.
pool to such a greater level. I actually personally think that they might try and stick to the two-year rule just because it's only been 2 years, and because on a resources for what they want the future of Modern Masters to be, is that by saving Innistrad block, that is such a big and important set that in 2 years from now, or whatever long it takes for Modern Masters 3 mm-hmm. to come out, they would have some of these high-value, high-profile cards,
right.
like Liliana and Snapcaster Mage yeah. and Avacyn and Grizzlebrand.
The concern is really, you know, they want Modern to be an affordable format. They've certainly
right.
shown that Modern Masters in and of itself is proof they want Modern to be affordable. And the reprinting of Fetchlands in Khans of Tarkir from Onslaught block, you know, we've got that much confirmed, and that's
right.
certainly going to increase the affordability of Modern as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're really focused on that, and that means I think they want to knock down some of these price ceilings, like
right.
especially Liliana the Veil, which is a real choke point for the format. If you want to play a black deck that's not a combo deck in Modern, you just need four
yeah.
Liliana the Veils. That's like just a mandatory
yeah, right.
inclusion for all intents and purposes, really. And that card's price is just going up so fast.
Right. Well, especially
yeah.
because the world is holding onto the table for Modern Masters 2. Fetchlands were just reprinted. So a lot of these cards that people might think won't be reprinted in Modern Masters 2 and aren't Fetchlands are rising in value because the previous barrier entry, the Fetchland, is now
mm-hmm. the bubble
burst. Priced.
Yeah.
yeah. You'll be able to get the allied ones coming out, which will be being played. And B, because the demand on Fetchlands of Zendikar block is lower, those prices are going down.
Yep.
So when one barrier to entry of the format goes down, then the other barriers start to rise.
It's specifically interesting to note with regard to Fetchlands too, that, you know, certain Fetchlands are going to be able to maintain a price and certain ones aren't. You know,
right.
like
mm-hmm.
Scalding Tarn, blue-red is a concentrated archetype in Modern, and you really don't want to be playing Flooded Strand or Polluted Delta instead of Scalding Tarn.
Right.
You want Scalding
right.
Tarn.
Right.
But then
its ability to actually fix your mana is
yeah.
as important as its ability
and
to
not
fetch
taking
shock
the
lands.
Shock off of the
right.
shock land is important. But then you take an archetype like, you know, Birthing Pod or Jund, which have occasionally played things like Marsh Flats. No thanks. They're
right.
going to go for those Windswept Heaths or
right, right.
Foothills or whatever, because it's not that big of a difference, and those cards let them splash colors they might be more interested in,
right.
and the mana base works.
And not to mention, and we may do an episode on this later on the exact ramifications of the new fetch lands, but the fact that, you know, there are archetypes that are probably were slightly worse or not playable because they didn't have access to allied fetches.
Mm-hmm.
Like Esper, for instance, probably wasn't as playable because it's a deck that wants to play Cryptic Command, but you can't play Cryptic Command off of, or very painlessly off of
yeah.
black-white,
mm-hmm.
the black-white fetch land.
You needed fetches for your wedge, essentially.
Right.
So,
getting into, like, I guess that's the first elephant in the room, and I think a lot of people think they're going to be reprinted in Modern Masters 2, and I'm personally of the belief that there's no way, is that I do not think the Zendikar fetches are going to be in Modern Masters 2.
I agree with you.
2.
I think the Zendikar fetches are going to be in the third Khans of Tarkir set.
Oh, see, I mean, we can get... I think they're coming next block. I think personally, and this is me calling another thing of the future, I think we're going to Zendikar block next fall. I think the return to Zendikar is next fall. I think we're getting a prequel set right now with Karns of Tarkir, and that they are going to reprint the allied fetches and the enemy fetches in return.
I think that's totally possible, but I still think that it makes more sense to me to put the Zen fetches, even if you're going back to Zendikar, in the third set of cons, because Zendikar is not really like the fetch lines aren't like Zendikar specific or anything. You know, there aren't only Rainforest in Zendikar,
true.
So you can avoid that issue. But also the way the limited format is balanced out, it really kind of creates like the same. It's a mirror, you know.
Right.
You've got cons. Mm-hmm. You do cons with its second set, and then when the third set comes out, it's going to shift to the third set with its second set.
Right.
So if you orient it that way, you've still got people opening. You've got people opening fetch lands all limited format long, which is a really strong drive for local game stores.
True.
Yeah.
And the two sides, I think, that why they'd probably be next set is, A, I think Landfall's coming back because it's by far the most popular
mechanic
on the set. And as a land in the set, they play the best with Landfall because they're actively affected.
I agree with you in that regard, except that the issue is, you know, they're rare, so you don't even really get to play with them in limited that often. And if they're in standard together, which they would be, you know, if they're oriented in cons the specific way, in fact, they would continue to be, because it's also the weird point where, you know, the sets break, and we go into that two-set standard rotation thing. So there would be fetch lands with Zendikar pretty much all the time.
Right.
You know, it's only going to be a small time window when they're not.
The last reason, and the last thing that I think, and this is maybe the bigger reason, is that Wizards like saving these kind of super big reprints for important moments, and the first set in the new block system that they're pushing, having another marquee card that people are going to want really badly seems like something that would encourage them to kind of wait until the next block instead of having only one block be like, this is all the fetches.
I don't disagree with you, but under that logic, why did they print them in cons?
A, because the modern format couldn't handle not having new fetches. Okay, we're diverging a little bit. So we'll probably include this conversation in another podcast about fetches, because we could talk about that forever.
Also known as Alex Doesn't Know.
Whoa. No one's going to hear that.
I know.
Never going to lose publicly.
I put it on.
Yeah.
I've done my due diligence.
Okay, so.
You can include some of the conversation. It's nice.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, we want to get in fetches. Will they be in?
Yeah.
So the next thing is of the mythic and important cards from Modern Masters 1, how many of them are they going to reprint in Modern Masters 2? How many are they going to avoid? Are we going to get Tarmogoyf again? Are we going to see so much of a consistency between the two? Or are we going to get brand new cards?
I don't know if you guys are looking at me. I'm all about reprinting that Tarmogoyf because I own zero.
That's a really good question, because those cards are still price ceilings in Modern. Like they have actually gone up significantly since they were reprinted.
Modern Masters 2 did more to increase their price than it did to
decrease. Which we talked about previously. And I think that Tarmogoyf, Dark Confidant, Vendilion Click, and Cryptic Commander are the four quote unquote offenders in this regard. Like they're the ones that are really big. Things like Vidalcan Shackles or whatever, they bounce down, but it's not a big deal.
I think if they're gonna do swords, they'll reprint the new ones. I think like a lot of cool things to get on the new set. I think Tarmogoyf for sure.
I think I'm honestly not sure. Like it's the sort of thing where like I would want to have a conversation and like try and figure out their philosophy before I really, you know, was guessing at it. I personally think they should reprint these cards again.
Right.
I think that they merit it. I think you want to increase the amount of them in the market. It can only be good for all of the formats involved, even Legacy. So, you know, I have no issue with it, and I think it would be a good thing for Magic. I can see them perhaps steering clear just because, you know, it feels like they're kind of retreading on themselves a little bit.
And the issue that you run into is there are only 15 slots for Mythic Rare.
Exactly.
Right.
And I think that they'll, I personally am of the firm belief that the Titans might be in this set as the five Mythic, more Timmy card Mythic set,
Dragons
were.
Well, yeah.
Partly because they're, you know, Primeval Titan is a played card, so I think they'd want to get Primeval Titan
in
there.
But there's no Titan Storm.
Or will there be?
card would be gas.
Yeah.
So you get the Titans in there, so that leaves only 10 real slots. I think they're going to do some mirroring. I think we're going to get 2 to 3 Planeswalkers. Yeah, Liliana,
Sorin.
Gideon, Sorin. Like, there's definitely choices. I think if we're at Innistrad, definitely Liliana. I think definitely Gideon as the white marquee one, and I think probably a gold one, and there could be many different options that.
There was only one in Modern Masters, right? Or the first one?
Modern Masters had two. They had Elspeth and Sarkhan Vol.
Yeah, okay.
And then
those were good plants too. Elspeth and the Theros, the and then Sarkhan right. Rolling Khans. Well, it's almost like they can see into the future.
Weird. I think that the swords. I think two of the swords might come back. I think we're gonna get a cool new version of Feast and Famine and a cool new version of War and Peace.
I could certainly believe that.
I could definitely see the swords coming
just because
back.
They were kind of the marquee of the last one, and you kind of since you're going to the next set, and maybe all three. It's possible.
Here's
no
the thing,
one likes
though.
Body and Mind.
Depends on how many slots you need to fill. And Body and Mind is like the most miserable limited experience of all time.
I mean, if you guys are going to go back to Eldrazi, though, I mean, are we going to waste any spots on those guys?
Oh, no. I think we're going to get into this. I think, actually, the Eldrazi draft archetype of red-green from Rise of the Eldrazi will be one of the draft archetypes. But I think we're going to get, if not all three, definitely Emrakul. And maybe a few of the lesser ones at lower rarities than Mythic.
Right.
Yeah, I could certainly see that. I could even see... I think they have to keep Emrakul Mythic just because he feels Mythic.
Oh, he's definitely a Mythic. Yeah, I mean...
He's the most Mythic of all Mythic-iness.
Right.
So,
both lore-wise and card-wise.
Yeah, I think we get Emrakul at Mythic, and I think we get, like, It That Betrays, and some of the
Artisan of Kozilek.
Artisan of Kozilek. Some of the... Yeah. And then, like, maybe, like, an Eldrazi at every rarity, kind of how they did in Rise of Eldrazi.
Mm-hmm.
Do, like, a vertical cycle.
Yeah.
And I think that's enough. I don't think you need to do all three of the Eldrazi Titans. I don't think that's
necessary. No,
definitely
not all three.
And you're not going... The only one player is going to be... Maybe two is going to be able to play it, depending on what the archetypes are.
Right.
So you're not going to really throw that in there.
Right.
I think there are four other cards that are... pretty pricey and modern, and also like ripe for potential reprint, depending on how they, you know, decide to skew things out. And I think those cards are Noble Hierarch.
Yeah, for sure.
Lynvala, Keeper of Silence, which is, you know, only a singleton in pod, but it's very casual popular and very expensive.
Yeah,
as
very
rare
expensive,
in a small printed set. Damnation, which is not good in modern, really. It doesn't see much play, but it's also, again, a very popular card that's difficult to obtain for a lot of players who want it.
Yeah.
And it was... interestingly missing from the Vault's Annihilation this year.
Yes.
And the article talking about it literally had a paragraph on, if cards aren't in here, it's probably because we're reprinting them within the next year.
Yeah.
So I think that is pretty likely for Damnation. And then also we have Snapcaster Mage.
Yeah.
Yeah, Snapcaster
Mage. Which,
definitely
one of the marquee cards for Modern and Legacy. Its price is not going anywhere. It is literally, like, if you could just buy Snapcaster Mages almost at any time, like 5 years later, just be selling them for more. That's just how the card works.
Yeah, it's just
it doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah. What do you guys think about cards like Karn or Elesh Norn?
I think there's a distinct possibility. My only concern with some of those is, you know, A, their ties into flavor are a little stronger than maybe others. Like, you know, you can get away with something like Emrakul if you're including the Eldrazi spawn as like one of the archetypes, whereas some of the other stuff, like the big Phyrexian Praetor, it's kind of like, well, what is that tie
right
into?
I think you have to do all the Praetors at the point.
I think it's very possible to get Karn.
That, but
yeah.
I think if maybe that is the third Planeswalker. I don't think we're going to get the Praetors, partly because they are a cycle.
Yeah.
And they kind of want to keep that cycle together. Maybe Elesh Norn, but in reality, I think the Titans are a little bit better for limited.
To have the five of.
And it's less of a, like... there's not such a weird disbalance between them, because like the blue and green Praetors are like 15 mana for all intents and purposes, while the cheaper ones are a little bit easier to cast.
So I guess we can talk about those a little bit more, because, you know, Noble Hierarch, again, most of the cards I named, with the exception of Lynvala and Damnation, and even Damnation a little bit, are also like legacy popular cards. So their price is really stable, and I think that Wizards wants to... even though they're not like showing a huge amount of support for Legacy, you know, when they can throw it a bone, I think they're willing to.
Right.
Oh yeah.
And Damnation is a card that would probably see more modern play now, especially because of the allied fetches I'm talking about.
Certainly
that.
Couldn't see less.
Right. So, you know, the black as a color has become a little bit more stronger, I think, with the new fetch additions, with the fact that the blue black fetch land now exists. So Damnation has a higher chance of seeing play. And I mean, the Tesserator deck that just did well at GP, I always say the name right, Kobe. And so, you know, it's definitely a card that is on the verge of playable. And a lot of people, you know, one of the reasons it and Wrath of God were kind of being oppressed play-wise is because people thought that you wanted to be playing Supreme Verdict. But because Thrun the Last Troll is a card, because Regeneration is actually kind of making a little bit of a comeback in the format, it's more important to have cards that get rid of them. And classically, the control deck has been white, but now that, you know, there are a little bit more reasons to be playing a black control deck in the format, it might lean towards Damnation seeing a little bit more play.
It could certainly, and I agree the fetches are a net positive. One, or I should say two more cards. I think Serum Visions is ripe for a reprint in Modern Masters too.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Right. It's
getting
a staple.
Quite high in price for really no good reason. The card is not even good, but people just have to play it. We've been shackled to it, essentially.
Right.
It's unfortunate, and nobody likes it, but that's how it is.
Yeah, and for a common, it should not be that pricey.
It's like $6, I think, right now, or something like that. So they're definitely going to probably want to knock that one down. And then we also have, last but not least, one of the more expensive cards in Modern, but one that I think is probably the least likely to get reprinted in Modern Masters 2, is Mox Opal.
Oh, right.
I think it's going to get there. I think one of the reasons that it's so hard to print that card anywhere else. I think it's similar to
I might not be here. You know?
Right. I think it with Noble Hierarch both have this weird situation where they have such a weird specific mechanic ability that they're really hard to reprint anywhere else.
I think Noble Hierarch, it's a lot more evergreen, you know. Like, we got Exalted in a base set, so that is much easier. And combat's, you know, universal. Every set has combat. So Noble Hierarch, you can put it in literally any set and its ability will be, you know, reasonable.
Right.
You can't do that with Mox Opal. You know,
true.
It's got to have something to pair up with. And because they had that strong artifact focus in Modern Masters 1, I'm not sure they're going to want to do that again. I think that Mox Opal might better pair with like a dual deck or a commander product, maybe, where you orient around that. And that's a better way to get it into the market. I don't necessarily think that'll happen. I think that that's just like, in my head, that's like a more organic, holistic way to kind of introduce the card.
Right.
I think there's a possibility that one of the archetypes will be artifact themed. I think that it won't be blue white. I think it might go in a direction of something different, like a black red sacrifice artifact theme, because that kind of was in Scars of Mirrodin, but it wasn't as focused as they originally designed the set to be, because development lowered both that and a proliferate draft archetype in the set originally that was there, which, you know, that plus the blue, you know, the cards that are in older sets kind of might give them the ability to really play that up. I think that's the only way they can do it. Not necessarily black-red, but I think if they change the archetype
to do something different if they do it at all.
Yeah,
and I think they may have just missed an opportunity in the last set, to be honest. But it'll be interesting, because I'm pretty sure that card needs a reprint. I don't think they want it to just balloon up to like $80 eventually, just because if you want to play one of the best decks in the format,
it's the only card that's expensive to get at this point.
Right. Yeah.
I think we're going to see the Nexus, though. I think we're definitely seeing the effect Nexus.
I could believe it. Its price is reasonable, but it's definitely a popular kind of card. People like it, and especially, you know, popularity has continued to go up thanks to Tom Ross. Infect shenanigans.
Well, I mean, it's in one major archetype, for sure. It's in Affinity, but then it's also in like a top tier two archetype, or at least a top played, which is Infect. And so, you know, it's in both of those archetypes. It is going to start going up, especially if they start reprinting all these cards. And it mirrors the first one. They had the first Nexus in the first one, so having the second Nexus and having a little bit of a Scars of Mirrodin, Infect invading kind of feel to it makes sense.
I could see him revisiting that.
Yeah. My question is, though, we like the swords, right? We think some of the swords will be reprinted.
I imagine so, just because people like them.
The only reason I think the swords might not be printed is because they did it in the last one. They're relatively recent and their price isn't like in a situation where it's ballooning.
They're not that great in Modern. Like, they reprinted the ones, you know, that are essentially doing a little better. Like, Sword of Light and Shadow is actually, I think, criminally underrated in Modern. It just doesn't get as much play as it should. But Sword of Fire Knights has long been, you know, the sword.
The only
the
sword
to see play, really.
Like, Feast of Famine is the closest one to actual playability. Yeah.
It's like a sometimes sideboard card in Legacy. Sometimes played card in Modern.
And it's infamous because it's, like, the card that made Cobblade put it on the map in many ways.
Yeah.
But the reason I think they might not do that is purely off of the face that there are only 15 slots at Mythic. And if they want to get, you know, a five just like filler set like the Titans or what the Dragons were originally, plus five like super like high profile reprints like Tarmogoyf or, you know, if Noble Hierarch is going to be Mythic or Snapcaster is Mythic, and they only have, you know, they can only do, they want to keep the colors equal. Like, if you look at Riddle Modern Masters, there was one super Mythic of each color, one Timmy Mythic of each color, and then a bunch of golden artifact cards.
Right.
So feels to me that it by printing the swords, they're wasting slots that don't really need to be printed.
There's some level of consideration for also, you know, when people open packs, how often do you want the pack to look kind of like packs from the last time? You know,
right,
like,
right.
Oh, I got a Tarmogoyf again. That's cool. And like everyone would be happy about that, but it is not a unique experience. You know?
Right, right.
Oh, I got one of these like six drop mythic rares. Okay. Oh, I got a sword. Okay. You know, like right. that's a mm-hmm. super similar experience. And I don't think we want to overlap that aggressively.
I agree. And, yeah. and I think. I mean, there's an argument that the Titans won't be in it if they want to kind of save slots for yeah. that. I think that for limited purposes, they like just having these weird bomby mythics.
And right. Well, that's
I agree.
How they. Right, right.
I think that the Titans are great. I mean, I think that they also, if you know, we do return to Zendikar, having a card like that's around for people to play with.
Right.
Obviously,
right.
Mm-hmm. You know, not in standard necessarily. Although they could do that. I don't think they would.
It reminds
but, I mean,
me.
I think on a casual basis, from a casual standpoint, yeah. you know, the onus behind Valakut is bad for tournament play, but if I'm a casual player and I bought some Modern Masters and now I bought some Zendikar, return the Zendikar packs, put them together, I'm going to have a great time with my friends, and it's
right.
not going mm-hmm. to be format warping because there's no format that they both
yeah,
exist.
So I think that there's definitely some perks to doing things like that.
Yes.
Yeah, what fixing do you think we're
going to
have?
So for fixing, because we're going back to Zendikar and because I think there's going to be a landfall-y theme possibly, I think that the bounce lands, the double cost black bounce lands at common, are possibly a likely chance of getting in there. They're a common mana fixing. They're a little complicated, but they have cool interactions with a lot of different things the set could be doing.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't reprinted in Modern Masters. They were printed in a lot of supplemental products, so they're definitely a popular tool for Wizards for mana fixing. And they're a little too complicated to ever be in standard again because they slow down the format. They're a very weird ability and possibly a little too powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And they have some fun shenanigans with some of the mythics we've described, like Primeval Titan. They might even put Amulet of Vigor in there for funsies, because that is seeing play in some formats. And if these lands are there, then it actually is a playable mm-hmm. and a card that you'd want in draft versus otherwise, which then they would just not do anything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There are other options, but this is kind of a set where they also don't need to print the rare cycle of lands or a rare cycle of lands, because it's so much about all of the cards are important and valuable. They like rare cycle lands to kind of supplement packs that they think might not be worth as yeah. much.
Right.
Because like the answer for Wizards, and like often they get a question like, why are these lands rare? Why not just make them common so everyone can play all the colors? And their answer is like, lands sell packs.
Yeah.
And we're in the business yeah. of making money. And so because of that, you know, and it makes it so that no matter what, you have a chance of opening something with your pack that is worth something.
Right.
So it makes you be motivated to open packs, because there's always going to be at least a cycle of cards in most big sets that holds value at least while it's in standard.
I do think there is some potential for exception. I agree with your logic in,
right.
In this regard. But we do have two cycles of lands that are pretty expensive in Modern, one of which is super unnecessarily expensive. Which is the filter lands,
right?
Originally
right.
from the Shadowmoor block, yeah.
Cascade Bluffs and all those.
Yeah, those are really, really expensive. And to be fair, I think their price is going to tank once you know, we get fetch
more
lands.
More of them,
yeah,
right.
Because you know that's one of the reasons that people play them, is they need the mana fixing. There really aren't as
right.
many, like, I don't have to take damage to put my land into play kind of things going on, and one damage is not negligible, but
yeah,
right.
So
yeah.
I think that we'll see a slight reduction in them, but they're still going to be around and they're still unnecessarily expensive. So
right.
I can see wanting to reprint them. At rare, of course, they wouldn't want to take up mythic slots.
Right, right.
And then the other possibility are the future site cycle of lands,
right,
because Horizon
be...
Canopy and Grove of the Burnwells
are just
getting crazy
right.
at this
and,
point.
And
right.
if I were to pick between those two, I'd pick the future site ones, just because there's only five, and they're also unique. They're all
mm-hmm.
very kind of cool in what they do.
Mm-hmm.
Where the filter lands are cool, and one of them is a filter land. You know, they have a cool ability, and a lot of them don't have regular borders, so it's also like a cool ability to like
yeah.
reprint these cards in a different way.
Right.
To kind of wrap up this part one of Mara Masters 2 that we'll be going over the next year, is, you know, kind of going to some of the archetypes that we think are going to exist. We went really into Modern Masters 1, every archetype they had,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think we're going to be able to predict every single one, but I think based off of the sets they're adding and some of the mechanics and some of the rares and mythics that we think they'd want to reprint anyways, there's some easier calls to make on what
yeah.
might be in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned this one first, and this is probably my favorite one that might be coming back, is a Eldrazi Spawn ramp deck in red-green. I think that was one of the most fun That was one of the most fun draft archetypes in Rise of the Eldrazi Original, which is one of the most fun formats ever.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it allows you to kind of get in those cards like Emrakul and Primeval Titan, can kind of see playing it, and it lets you print really cool splashy cards in those sets, and you get all these cool Eldrazi. I think that green-black is very possibly to be in Infect. I think that it's a mechanic that a subset of players love. I think a subset of players hate them also, but I think it's probably cancels each other out. I think doing Infect in a different environment than what it was in Scars of Mirrodin, where it was really you either had to be Infect or you had to be the deck that's playing against Infect, which was very stratifying. And I think you can also make it a little bit less of what it was in the original format, which was like really small creatures and pump spells aggro, and make it much more kind of what it ended up being towards the end of the block of Scars of Mirrodin block, which was more of a mid-rangey, bigger creature, slower, and more much more about grinding and advantage. Right. The other cool thing about Infect is that there are cards that kind of go well with Infect that actually go with the ability that Infect was based off of, which is Wither. Where Wither, you know, there are mechanics from the set that Wither was in, which Wither is it's half of Infect. So Infect is creatures do damage in minus one counters or poison. Wither is just they do damage to players regularly, but they do minus one counters to creatures.
To creatures, right.
And there are cards that kind of mechanically work with them that were originally in the sets that Wither was in, and so that could be cool to see with it. There's also like fun poison cards like Sliver from Time. There's a Sliver with poison in Time Spiral block, and so like you can kind of sneak in a few of like the Time Shifted and Future Sighted poison cards to have kind of a cool like slightly different version of Infect. I think from Zendikar Black, I think for sure we're getting something maybe along the lines of what Boros Bushwhacker was in Standard, which is all the efficient red-white aggro landfall creatures, which is Steplinks and
Plated
Geopede. So these are cards that when you play a land, they get +2/+2. This is what, one of the reasons I think that the bounce lands are possible to come back, because they will play really well with these landfall creatures, because it's not like fetch lands where you can get like a 4/4 on turn one. Or attack for four on turn two. But what you do get is you can just consistently keep playing. Right. You have consistent lands in your hand, so you can consistently keep going for it. And the second one I think is a possibility from Zendikar is Allies. They're kind of a fan favorite. They kind of play similar to Slivers.
It's a reasonable read.
Green-white is kind of has enough in just those two colors to kind of play enough of them for the draft format at all where it is. And you can maybe print some in red. And it kind of goes with the Boros Bushwhacker kind of landfall aggro archetype. Also, because, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, I do think we're going to Zendikar soon, if not next block, very like within the next couple of years. It puts these ally cards into newer players' hands, so that when new allies come out in the next Zendikar set, if they're coming back, it allows them to build the like have the cards for making these like casual ally tribal decks.
I think those are all reasonable guesses. I mean, I'm not like crazy about all of them. I think that there's a reasonably strong chance at Eldrazi because it's so popular, and I've mentioned before they like to take things that were popular and pull them in.
Right.
So I think that that one's got probably the strongest of those. Infect is not as popular. In fact, it was kind of like a little reviled at times. So I'm a little wary of that one. I think that they wouldn't mind doing it. It's not like objectively anyone at Wizards is like, this would be a horrible idea. Right. It's just like, you know, we have this idea. Is there maybe a different idea we should use? That kind of thing could be going on.
Right.
And allies were also, you know, like pretty cool. As far as me, as far as tribes, I've kind of been thinking about, you know, because you don't really want to just rehash everything you did before, right?
Right.
So I think that like zombies and merfolk both have like strong shots because they're both even like they're both modern legal and reasonable. Like there are some zombie decks that aren't terrible, and there's definitely a merfolk deck that's not bad.
And you get stuff like Gravecrawler, especially if Innistrad is in the format. Right. You get Gravecrawler, you get
Garalf's Messenger. Yeah. You can do a lot of cool things.
Right. You do a blue black zombie situation, and you do like a blue white merfolk, because merfolk is definitely. It was one of the tribes that I felt was most obviously missing from the original Modern Masters. I think a lot of people were like, well, that's weird. That's kind of that and elves are probably the archetypes that are missing.
I think elves is, maybe, because it's like not that good in Modern, and it's also not a deck they really want to be good in Modern. Like, everybody wants the, all right, do your thing.
And the attainability of the cards isn't too bad either.
Yeah.
And when it comes down to it, something I think they will always be conscientious in these sets is thinking of the future, and I think they will be. There will eventually be a Modern Masters 3, and we don't want to do every single one of our major tribes. We want to save one of them. And I think Merfolk is a little bit more of a deck right now anyways. I think that most of the cards for Merfolk are in the sets that would be available. And the colors that it is in are a slot that needs to be filled, yeah. and they want it to be different than the classic either blue-white flyers or you know, what the first one was blue-white artifacts. So that is an archetype that blue-white can go into that is also different than what they've done classic. You know, that is different than what normally this draft environment would normally be.
Mechanically speaking, I've already mentioned I would like to see graveyard slash flashback stuff from Innistrad come back, which again, you know, we've mentioned that's dependent on whether or not Innistrad is actually included in the sets they decide to reprint from. But I think that that's, you know, again, super popular among players. They would love it, and I think Wizards wants to do something like that.
It's a great blue-red kind of, like,
yeah,
if I was going
to everyone loves Burning Vengeance.
Right. So that's kind of, we don't want to go too much farther into what kind of archetypes there are, because this could very well change very quickly.
Yeah, we don't
want to
spoil it for you guys.
Yeah, you guys might find out. So to kind of wrap up Modern Masters 2 before we get into the deck tech, we want to go into just possible issues that might come with Modern Masters.
Nothing. It'll be perfect.
It'll be perfect. Okay.
Next.
All right. So that's kind of that for that.
Let's talk some deck tech.
All right. So we're going to, you know, this is the last part in every episode. We're going to do a deck tech. Today we're doing blue, white, red control.
All right. Which... you're going to basically teach me about this deck because you guys clearly know exactly how this works.
Yeah. Well, blue, white, red first really became a deck in Modern on the back of Geist's Aintraff. That was how everyone was kind of familiar with it. And that was more of a blue, white, red aggro or mid range deck. You know, it actually started off pretty aggressive. There were versions with like Steplinks and whatnot going around. So it was just attack, 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 play this 3-mana, 2-2 hexproof guy that makes a 4-4 angel and just beat people to death.
Right.
Pretty solid strategy.
Yeah, exactly. But as the format kind of, you know, shifted and then we got like Deathrite Shaman Liliana of the Veil came along, which let people accelerate into a edict effect, make someone sacrifice a creature.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, a hexproof 2-2 became a lot less reliable way to kill the opponent. So it became more of a mid-range deck. It started playing Restoration Angel for a 3-4 Flash Flyer to kind of give it an additional, you know, potential to win the game. Celestial Colonnade, a land that becomes a 4-4 Flyer, was added to the mix. So it shifted into this mid-range deck that was also pretty good. I played that deck at some events as well. And then Wafo Tapa came
2012?
Along.
2012?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
What's Wafo Tapa?
Guillaume Wafo Tapa is one of the best Magic players in the world.
Well known as
a control expert. If you have trouble with his French name, you can go with Guacamole Wafo Tacos. That's totally fine.
That's the American version.
Yeah. So he's great, and he designs very powerful control decks. That's just what he does. And he took that deck and essentially cut basically all of the creatures, just Snapcaster Mage was left.
Yep.
And filled it with removal and card advantage, and that became Blue White Red Control, a very early version of it. And it's remained relatively similar since. People change which cards they're sideboarding. They change some of the tinker slots in the main deck, but I would say
the win condition,
things like Batterskull have been around. Right. Sometimes they've played things like Sun Titan, but the core win condition, the core engine, I should say, remains the same. You're trying to play like early efficient removal, then you're trying to play card advantage favorable removal like Snapcaster Mage and Electrolyze, which is a shock that draws a card and can be split around for 3 mana.
Right.
Pretty handy. And then you move into, again, more card advantage. You've got Cryptic Command, counter spell, draw a card, or, you know, do whatever else you want.
Yeah,
it reads just do whatever you want.
Tell your opponent to dance. And with Snapcaster Mage to flash it back, obviously that card is also very powerful. And you had counter spells in addition to Cryptic Command to control the early game. Remand and Mana Leak both are very cheap and, you know, not super reliable, but temporarily can handle most of the stuff you'll see in the early turns. So the deck really builds to a late game, and Wafo Tapa's version generally just beat the opponent to death with Celestial Colonnade.
Right.
That was pretty much the plan.
Colonnade and Snapcaster Mage.
Yeah.
Right.
With a Lightning Bolt to the face on occasion. Because it ends up that Snapcaster Mage and Lightning Bolt together kind of are good.
And in the mirror, that actually became like one of the key fighting points. You had to try and burn the opponent out because eventually somebody is going to be much farther ahead and that person is going to Celestial Colonnade the other one to death.
Right. My first question, just looking at these cards, is Sphinx's Revelation is quickly going out of... Oh, no, this is Modern.
This
is not Standard.
And to be fair, Sphinx of Revelation does see play in a lot of these decks. I think Wafo Tapa played two in his first version, but it's generally become a one-of or maybe a sideboard card in some. So, you know, that was how the deck was for a really long time. It saw a lot of success on Magic Online and didn't see much going on live until really Pro Tour Born of the Gods, where it won.
Well, I mean, it was heralded when Blood Raid Elf first got banned, and it was that, and the Storm deck kind of got banned. It was the first deck out of the gate that people thought was going to be the major format, and so the format warped around beating it. pretty heavily right after that banning, because there was GP San Diego's right after that, and right. So it ended up with a world where it was kind of hated on, and then, you know, like when a deck is like that, it takes a little bit longer for it to come back and make up for that fact.
So it essentially warped the meta around it a little bit because it was powerful enough.
It wasn't super warping. I think the deck was always more popular in Modo than real life up until this year.
True.
And that was where it was seeing the majority of its success. And I think that a lot of that is because, you know, good players played it on Magic Online, and also their, you know, time is less of an issue because your speed right. is all you need to really worry about.
Right, right.
So I think that all of that contributed to it, and the fact that, you know, Birthing Pot and Jund were the big decks in real life, those decks aren't, you know, always really favorable depending on right. your build. But the format, you know, hit a sweet spot, and as we saw at Pro Tour Born of the Gods, Sean McLaren was able to win the tournament with his build, which featured a very adaptable sideboard. He had a lot of cards that overlapped, a lot of singletons, but he could kind of customize his deck to mm-hmm, be
right.
whatever he was facing, which I think that's one of the primary strengths of Blue Red. I think most of those sideboards, you really want like at least 10 unique cards because you want to be able to mix and match very right, specifically, right. especially right. when you have a card like Snapcaster Mage to let you reuse specific cards right. over and over.
It's interesting because the deck also, the way it digs is, and it lets you get to these singleton cards, is that almost every one of his cards, or a significant chunk of his cards, draw more cards.
Right. Mm-hmm. So Sphinx's Revelation, the...
well, not even Sphinx, like Cryptic Command just draws a card. Command, if you're playing Command, just draws a card. Electrolyzer, you're playing Electrolyzer. Right. Draws a card, like they all cantrip, so like your hand is always consistently being searching through your deck. It's right. different than like some classic controls, which, you know, Sphinx's Revelation is kind of a marquee like card for that, where it's like stall, draw a bunch of cards. Or, and it's different than like some of the more legacy based control decks, mm-hmm. where it's like one mana, you know, filter through the top of my deck cards are how I kind of search. This is mm-hmm. much more of a, every card in my deck is a cantrip, mm-hmm. or Snapcaster Mage, which is basically a cantrip, and so it lets you get through really quick. The other right. thing is the deck, most of its threats are instant speed. They all either have flash or they're a land. so things like Restoration Angel can come into play on the end of your opponent's control, so you're always ready right. for kind of what they're doing. There's not really a point where the deck is opening itself up for your shenanigans.
To be even more specific, the cards serve dual roles. You know, not necessarily just flash, but they always do something in addition to kill. You're never just spending a card slot on a kill condition, like Aetherling, for example, which is like, mm-hmm. When you draw that card, it's nothing until you're winning.
Right.
Celestial Colonnade, it makes white and blue mana until you're winning. That's
right.
what it does.
Right.
Restoration Angel, it can block until you're winning.
Right.
It frequently does.
Right. Well, and not to mention it can reuse Snapcaster Mages or save your Vendilion Celestial Click. Colonnade. Or also, if you're playing Vendilion Click, it can rebuy the Vendilion Click ability.
Yeah, so the real strength is that none of your cards are ever blank as a control deck, which is a rarity. You
right.
know, often mm-hmm. you get into spots where they are. And especially removal, which is, you know, very typically in control mirrors, the person who draws the most removal is going to be a significant disadvantage. But in the blue-white-red mirror, because there's so much burn,
right.
Things like Lightning Bolt and Lightning Helix are actually not that unreasonable. Right. That's how you can close out a game. And Electrolyze is obviously a free roll. You just take two, I draw.
Like the least two versatile cards are probably Path and Mana Leak, and mm-hmm. there is even things like Path can, in the control mirror, is one of the best answers to Colonnade.
Yep.
Mana Leak is probably the weaker card, but it also, because you're playing cards like Tectonic Edge, you can keep in that battle them lower on mana, allowing you to Mana Leak the cards that are really important.
Yeah, there are some, you know, issues with the deck, like Path to Exile against Tectonic Edge and Mana Leak is really awkward, but that's how good Path is. And Mana Leak really mostly, its existence strangles the opponent in some regards. Like, they have to play around it
with opening three up.
Which lets you get to the later game, and then you know, normally in games two, you can side those out for more versatile control matchup cards.
I think we should probably talk about the next iteration of Blue-White-Red control from this, you know, heavy light
Blue,
creature
white,
version.
Right.
Yeah, which, mm-hmm. you know, Sean McLaren again did it at a Grand Prix shortly after his Pro Tour win. He played a version that had been on Magic Online for a while. I can't recall who I saw playing it first, but it had been there for quite a while as sort of an under-the-radar thing, running a lot more creatures, and specifically running Kiki Jiki Mirror Breaker to go with those Restoration Angels and be able to make infinite angels.
Right. And you play Wall of Omens, so you can get value out of the Restoration Angel, and you get value out of Kiki Jiki. You're playing, some lists play Blade Splicer to get a little bit more value and a little bit more of a roadblock in the middle game. But the nice thing about that, and my personal problem while playing Blue White Red in the past, is that the deck, when you win with the deck, it feels like you barely just won.
Right.
Where with the Kiki Jiki plan, there's this weird game plan that even if you're not, like, that's not how you're winning and you're still just winning with Celestial Colonnades, there feels like there's an end game plan B that your opponent needs to be wary of that can allow you to kind of grind through your matches a little bit more with a plan and intent versus I'm going to just value them out and at random moments I'm going to get them in for three and kind of snap mage, you know, snapcaster mage, lightning bolt at them so that their damage is going down. It's like, no, I'm playing towards a goal. Mm-hmm. And
right. Well, the way I see is if you get Kikijiki out and Restoration Angel, it doesn't matter what the board state is, you essentially win.
Yes.
Right.
That is exactly what happens.
Right. Excluding Torpor Orb shenanigans.
Right.
Kikijiki is, you know, a card like Aetherling that we discussed where it's pretty much only going to work when you've got the game already won anyway. It's a blank in most other regards. So some of the cards you've added are fine, like Wall of Omens, you know, it blocks and draws a card. So it's close to free. And Restoration Angel, which, you know, we've already sung its praises.
Yeah.
But Kikijiki does come at that cost of, I don't do anything unless I'm about to win.
Right. It is also,
the most part.
It is also
you can use it with these other cards a little bit, but it's really not that good.
Right.
It also has a level of mana cost difficulty. It is a triple red creature in a deck that classically was more splashing red than actually fully playing it.
Right,
with both
absolutely.
Feet in. So you have to kind of tweak your mana to kind of go along with that. Yep. It also... But... I mean, yes, it kind of does that, but it also, you know, I've won games with blue, white, red where I just attack for two because Kikijiki is a haste 2/2 for five. And in a deck where, like, you're bolting them and snapcastering them, you can get them pretty low, and sometimes just you need that last card to get them in there, and Kikijiki is a haste 2/2.
Or you can just make someone else big enough, like copying even like a Celestial to creature to swing it in.
Well, that requires a lot of mana, actually.
That's true.
Actions. But, I think the biggest incentive to playing Kikijiki is you give up this slot in your deck that could be more interactive, and in exchange, you get a card that really lets you turn around some of your bad matchups, specifically combo decks or especially big mana decks like Tron, which is a horrible matchup because beating someone to death with a Celestial Colonnade before they cast a bunch of Wyrmcoil Engines or Emrakul is really tricky, actually.
Yeah, well, I mean, it ends up that a deck like this has a very, very, very big problem with a turn three Karn.
It can be tricky.
And
Tron, obviously, the deck that is most resilient to Mana Leak, which is your primary form of interaction before you get Cryptic Command online.
Right.
So, you know, if they simply open on two towers and the other two Tron lands, there's nothing you can do about anything. Really.
Well, I mean, your Tron matchup, the other, Lightning Bolt doesn't really do anything against them.
Nope.
Path
you have
eventually
so
might
blanks.
Do something.
Path is solid because it handles the Wyrmcoils. But you have a lot of difficulty with the
Remand is even hard because like they're casting spells that are just way better than anything you can be drawing into.
Right.
Mana Leak doesn't do anything, and they have a level of inevitability because eventually they can get like your game plan is to go as long as possible, but their long game plan is way better than yours because it's Emrakul, and Emrakul can't be countered, and can't be targeted by any of the spells in your deck.
Yeah, it is close to unbeatable when cast by the Tron opponent. You could like theoretically interact with it, but you're still not likely to win the game, which is the big issue. The blue-white-red deck is building to a specific point in the game and trying to leverage its mana advantage because that's the plus of playing with cantrips, right? You get spells and lands. I make my land drop and I play a spell every turn because none of my spells are actually costing me cards.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to this point in the game where you have way more mana and way more options at the same time.
Right.
The Tron deck is doing the exact same thing, but their options are better.
Right. I mean, like the real advantages you have are that you're doing everything at flash speed, so you do have a little bit more of like an understanding of what you're going to play, while Tron is definitely playing more of a tap out kind of situation.
Right.
Mind you, the things you can do and the reason why Kikijiki has been adopted by these decks is that your options aren't that great in the first place. So having this inevitability of drawing towards a Kikijiki of something that can just outright kill them is really, really a useful tool. And especially in game ones. Because in game twos, you can mitigate this matchup because you have cards like Stony Silence in the sideboard, which we've talked about before, which is very powerful against specifically decks like Tron and Affinity. And so it's really very helpful in this specific matchup.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons that, as you said earlier, your sideboard is almost a piece of art, the blue, white, red, because every card is very specific and it's meant to kind of carry over into different matchups and play differently depending on who you're playing against.
So you might have noticed that since we've discussed the history of blue, white, red, we've kind of come up with, you know, a lot of different blue, white, red decks. In fact, we've named, you know, four that have, you know, probably about 12 to 20 cards different between them. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons that the deck is kind of good in Modern, because it's very difficult to figure out exactly what your opponent's on until you may have already made a very costly mistake. We've mentioned before how fast Modern can be, how it's a format where generally on turn four, your opponent's going to kind of show themselves. Like, this is how I'm going to try and win. And, you know, against a deck like Blue Eye Red, you could have already made a mistake that's so significant you might actually die as a result of a cascading disadvantage. So I think that that's one of the selling points of Blue Eye Red is it kind of camouflages itself very naturally because you're never quite exactly sure which archetype your opponent's on for at least the first few turns.
And especially going into game two, because the situation is like, is this deck playing Geist now? Geist is ain't try. Like, should I keep my Lightning Bolts in because I need to get rid of Kiki Jiki? Or if I'm keeping these in, are they going to start playing cards like Geist is ain't Trapped, where now six cards in my hand are dead and he has a six damage coming in my face every turn?
And like, even if you know everything, it's entirely possible they sideboard into like a transformative style. Like, a lot of times you're boarding out Kiki Jiki against some of these decks, so they'll, you know, try and defend themselves from a Kiki Jiki Angel Kill with something like, you know, a Combust or keeping their bolts or whatever, and then you're just like, no, I'm still just going to Sphinx's Revelation you out, and that's how you win. And
okay, now I'm Sphinx and Keranos, and you're not going to be able to do anything to me because all my win conditions are like untargetable and destructible.
Kieran, good call. That card is handy.
Right. Yeah. It ends up that card, you should be getting it because it's going to be good in Standard and it is already good in Modern.
Yeah.
Actually, I think it already went up to 17.
It's pretty good in Commander.
Yeah, it's actually doing pretty big business on the market right now. Yeah. I've been borrowing my roommate's and he's taking it back so we can sell it.
I think I have the one for the sideboard in this deck. And
so
then
we talked a lot about the Tron matchup, which is actually one of the less common matchups for Blue White Red. Right. So why don't we run through some of the Tier 1 decks and we can kind of talk about how, you know, you might approach those matchups. Jimmy, why don't you...
Yeah, all right, guys. So the biggest one is Bug Control Uber.
I think what he meant to say was Birthing Pod.
Birthing Pod, right.
Very similar. So Birthing Pod, we talked a little bit about before, and it's a really value-oriented deck. It has a great late game, and, you know, it's public enemy number one kind of in Modern because it's so good.
It's popular, strong, and can... Its game plan, which is game B game plan, is very versatile because it can just start beating you down instead of going for any kind of combos.
The matchup kind of works in two different ways. If they have a Birthing Pod in play, it works around controlling that Birthing Pod because a lot of bad things can happen if your opponent's potting.
Right.
It takes out, I mean, like, if you think about it, Birthing Pod makes it so every spell they basically pay for the rest of the game is uncounterable because they're not playing spells, they're potting
it. They're potting it out.
Or they're playing one drops or two drops, which are cheap, which your late-game counterspell magic doesn't really do anything against.
And thanks to Persist, a lot of their cards are generating value, which means they can overcome things even like Cryptic Command or Sphinx's Revelation and Electrolyze because they're just running you out. You're drawing cards every turn, two cards a turn, they're drawing better.
Yep.
And the big issue with that is they build up to a Revelark. Revelark is really probably the most deadly card in the matchup.
Right.
So a lot of players, and Sean McLaren is a big proponent of this strategy with Blue White Red, is he actually boards in his Relic of Progenitus to try and help control specifically Revelark.
Right.
It's the most dangerous card, and you really don't want to pop that Relic until you've gotten the Revelark handled. Now, fortunately, the pod deck generally only runs one of a lot of things, including specifically Revelark. So once you've handled something like that, you don't necessarily have to go through it again.
Right.
And that's a good thing. The other plan they have is the beats. You know, their deck is a pretty reasonable mid-range beatdown deck with all that Persist, and Gavinny Township keeps the Persist creatures beating on you even longer.
I mean, the deck is built out of mostly mana creatures, value creatures, or bullets, and the mana creatures and value creatures fill the board up, and when you start gavening townships, making them all 4/4, 5/5, 6/6s, it becomes much more difficult for the control player to really handle what's coming at you. And because some of these creatures have persist, and with gavening township are infinitely persisting, you have the issue of, you know, even board wipes aren't that powerful against them. So you really have to kind of pick your answers to them very specifically, and maybe go with things like Relic of Genesis or, you know, the single bullets of like Grafdigger's Cage, which kind of shuts down their pod and makes it so their value creatures don't work as well as they normally would. So like, it ends up Graveyard Hate is one of the better things to do against pod because so much of their deck revolves around value that is based off of cycling through or out of their graveyard.
So I personally find that the best plan of attack is to try and shut down the pod and then treat them like a particularly resilient mid-range deck. So you're going for those Grafdigger's Cages and even Stony Silence.
Right.
Because you just need to turn the pod off, and then the relics work great with that plan as well because they cut off their main forms of inevitability from there.
I guess to go on to further matchups, Green-Black X.
Green-Black X, Jun, Junk, and the Golgari mid-range decks.
Right.
They all function pretty similarly. You mostly have to worry about the cards they're splashing for, which in the case of the red deck is mostly Lightning Bolt, not a big concern for you. Yeah, so
though
that deck is probably the better matchup.
With Junk, you have Lingering Souls, which is a little bit
slightly more of a concern for you.
So as you have choices in kind of deciding what your deck is doing and what is attacking, these green-black decks, that is one of their strengths as well. And one of the resistant things they have is you don't know exactly what you're getting into until they start playing the other color. You know, they go from consistency and just straight green-black. They go to better removal and a little bit more reach with a green-black-red, and they have the options of the value game of green, black, white, which comes with Lingering Souls. Sometimes it comes with Kitchen Finks. These are decks that, you know, are value games, which is, again, a problem that sometimes Blue-White has. But the other side of it is that a lot of the time they're just playing Bob, who is, you know, just a value creature that you can kill because your deck is filled with removal spells that do have X1s.
That's really the core of the way you want to approach the matchup. And it's because, you know, the deck has so many cards that it shares, these green-black decks. So much of the cards don't change. And specifically, I think Dark Confidant is, in fact, the most important level of interaction. Liliana is secondary, but also very important.
Right.
It's because these are the two ways that, they can really attack you and get you.
Right.
So if they open up on Thoughtseizer Inquisition, can resolve a Liliana and deplete you of answers and then play a Bob, they're going to be in a hugely advantageous position because they're going to be able to just outlong game you. So in the matchup, really the key is killing everything. Kill the Bob. Always kill the Bob. It doesn't matter how you have to kill it. If you have to path to exile the Bob, yes, that is ugly. Yes, you have to do it. So that's very important. And aside from that, you want to avoid getting beat to death. The man lands can be especially troublesome because Jund is on a similar plan to you. That's how they're going to beat Flooding in the long game. They're going to Raging Ravine or Treetop Village people to death.
Which are both man lands that become 3/3s or bigger, and which poses a problem.
Yeah, they again, you know, produce mana and then become threats in the late game, and that's really the key, and you want to be able to interact with them. The blue-white-red decks that run the Tectonic Edge, which we already mentioned as a land that can destroy other lands, those decks are going to be a little bit more of a favorite, and that's why I think the Kiki Jiki version is much worse, because it can't run all those.
Next, we're going to talk about Affinity, which is, we've talked about in the first episode of the podcast, this is the objectively major aggro deck in the format. And your deck is, this is probably one of the bigger reasons to play this, because your deck is a little bit more resistant to this matchup. As we said, you know, you have Stony Silence on the sideboard, which is a great card against them, but your deck is almost main board. You know, it ends up that Electrolyze is a very, very good card against a deck that's filled with a bunch of 1/1s.
Yeah. I think the Affinity matchup is probably the best reason to be playing Blue or Red. There's really only two plans of attack you really have to worry about, which is their manland-based plan of attack, coming especially if it gets backed by a Cranial Plating, which you have to keep off the board or unequipped at all costs. So that can be very dangerous. And Etch Champion, which if it resolves and is metal-crafted, you basically can't touch it. So versions with Blade Splicer are a little more resilient to the Etch Champion, but personally, I like to just run some good old-fashioned Wrath of God. It gets through Welding Jar, it handles Thrun and other matchups. It's just all you need.
It's very strong in the format. It helps, and it's also good against some of the other tier 2, tier 3 aggro decks that are out there. Even if those are not the best decks in the format, it is something that you want to be prepared to play because they're always going to be there. Yep. People are going to be playing Zoo. People are going to be playing Merfolk. People are going to be playing these decks, that it's good to have some type of way to clear out the board of creatures. Otherwise, you might be getting punched in the face a little faster than you're able to handle.
And you have a lot of options. You have Wrath of God and you have Supreme Verdict, which, you know, have their pros and cons. The Wrath gets through Welding Jar and Thrun. The Supreme Verdict can't be countered by you know, the blue decks, which specifically comes up against Geist of St. Traffs that you might fight against. So you kind of have to make your peace with that. And keep in mind, I really like running one of these minimum in every 75 because I have Snapcaster Mage in my deck. So if I run one Wrath, I have
at
two.
At least two, right?
Yeah.
This is a question for you, I guess. Does Anger the Gods ever kind of come into play with Blue-White Red?
I'm not a big fan of it. I don't think it's well positioned right now. Okay. It's really good against Pod and pretty miserable elsewhere. Because as I mentioned against Affinity, you know, it's, you can handle all their little dorks. That's not a problem.
It's their two.
Yeah, it's the Edge Champion and the Manlands that you have to worry about. And the Anger of the Gods does nothing against both. Right. So I think that it's, again, you know, if you want to run a one of or maybe a two of, specifically with a Pod matchup, I think it's fine. But I prefer to interact with them a little more aggressively with things like Magma Spray, perhaps, which, you know, can handle Kitchen Finks or Voice of Resurgence, which is a real tricky guy since he turns off your counter magic and is also a value creature when he dies.
So to go with the last of our gauntlet of decks that we're going to talk about, hopefully in every episode, Splinter Twin. What would you say is your matchup with Splinter Twin with Blue-White Red?
I have generally found it to be very favorable. I have also heard Splinter Twin people who think that I'm insane. I think that one of the reasons is I designed my deck specifically, my sideboard, for the cards I'm planning to board in against decks like Splinter Twin.
Right.
I designed my sideboard so that I can cast it under a Blood Moon.
Right.
I think that that's really important, and people don't really think about it. So, you know, a lot of, for example, at a Grand Prix, you know, I had a sideboard that was like, I don't know, like 12 red cards. It was just, that was all I was going to do because Blood Moon had just started to hit it big. And, you know, people would board it in against me naturally. And it is difficult. You know, you have to work your way through it. But as long as you can keep them from actually being able to get you, and you can get either an island or a plains, preferably both into play, you know, you can work through it. You can definitely adjust. So I like Combust a lot more than most people for that reason. And I like Combust because it's also very good in the mirror. It's a great way to kill Restoration Angel and Celestial Colonnade, and it doesn't give the opponent a land like Path to Exile. So I'm a bigger fan of Combust than most people. Generally speaking, I like to have one permanent-based way to shut off Twin, just to like make them honestly answer it. Something like a Torpor Orb, which I don't like that much because of Snapcaster Mage being better in my deck than in theirs.
Right.
Or more specifically, a Spellskite, which is easier for them to answer, but equally difficult and also has applications in other matches.
Right. Torpor Orb ends up being a little bit more limited in what it's good against, while Spellskite has game against, you know, random aggro decks, but more specifically like Noggles or Splinterton decks, things that are trying to suit up a guy with an enchantment. Right.
So so basically by having one or two permanent based ways to kind of shut off the combo, I give them a hoop to jump through, which can create some windows for me to tap out every now and then.
Because
it's not realistic that I'm going to be able to defend myself on every turn of the game for the entire game. That's tough.
Right.
Combust is a big aid in that because it can't be countered, but you know, you have to find it. So having some permanent-based solutions forces them to spread out, and I find that a lot of the time they move more aggressively into the Blood Moon and attack you to death plan, as opposed to trying to twin you out because your deck is, you know, all removal. It's not a good plan. I think that the fetch lands that are coming are going to be very helpful because getting another blue fetch is going to be a nice one, especially if you're Floodage Strand specifically is much better than Arid Mesa, I think. If you decide to build your deck around post-board against this deck, you turn into, you know, more specifically a blue-red or white-red deck, depending on how you want to go in order to fight off the Blood Moon.
Right. And I would maybe recommend aiming towards more of the white-red because there are cards like Wear and Tear where you can play these good sideboard cards that also have some game against Blood Moon. Being able to answer a Blood Moon is also a decent way to do it. Yes. And Wear and Tear is not completely unapplicable as a card against them because they do also kind of bring in Spellskite sometimes or other cards that are artifacts that are good against you, and you can use the tear part to your lands are mountains, you can still destroy an artifact.
Yeah. I think that Wear and Tear is great. It's also pretty good now that Affinity has started playing in Soul Artifact because it's a card you can bring in against them that answers that as well. So keep in mind, the big thing about the Twin deck is going long, they don't have a way to fill up like you do. Their deck is all cantrips. They're designed to put together a combo, so that makes sense. But they don't have anything like a Sphinx's Revelation or Snapcaster Cryptic generally to pull a really strong long game together. Even though they run often Snapcaster Mage and or Cryptic Command, they can't manipulate it the same way you do. Because once they have 10 mana in play, they do the same thing that they do with 4 mana in play. They're just trying to twin up a guy. That's it. So they're trying to beat you to death with their little creatures if they can't do that. And having a bunch of lands doesn't really help them. So you can flood them out. If they have a Desolate Lighthouse, you want to make sure you can destroy that.
Right.
Because it's one of their ways to fight through that flood. And outside of that, you know, just kind of build into that long game where your deck is much more comfortable than theirs. Just don't die.
Right. Yeah. So that, I mean, I think that kind of breaks down the different matchups that the major matchups you need to be worried about with Blue, White, Red. And that kind of is the end of the episode, so we're
going to
wrap it up.
Well, guys, I will say I learned a lot, and I also learned that I don't know a lot about Modern. So
we're going to get you there. This podcast will be very helpful.
I would say that.
And others like you.
Definitely.
I mean, you went to your first FNM last week, and now you're learning about Blue, White, Red. You know, we're going to get you there. One day, we're going to have you win a Pro Tour.
I wouldn't mind top eighting a Pro Tour to start.
Just to start.
You know, I think that's a good first goal to set, you know, guys?
Right. Perfect. Well, we'll get you there.
I'll top eight some GPs, right? The competition's a little less fierce.
Oh, yeah. GPs are easy. Everybody top eight.
Who hasn't top eight a GP?
I mean, come on, guys.
All right. Well, you know, thank you guys for listening and, you know, signing off. You can follow us at TheMMCast on Twitter, and our email is actually TheMMCast@rocketjump.com. You can follow me personally at Kess Wiley on Twitter.
You can follow me, Glenn Jones, at Secluded Glenn on Twitter.
And you can just find me at JF Wong on Twitter.
He has an official Twitter account. He has a little blue check mark.
I do have a little blue check mark. Someone was kind enough at Twitter to like be like, I think this person is a real human being.
Yeah.
You should all have blue check marks. You should be able to send in your ID and they'd be like, okay, yeah, this person is real.
Well, once everybody's verified, nobody's verified, right?
Oh, like, goodness.
Now I'm confused.
That's true, actually. It's a dangerous road that we lead. I also run the Command Zone, which is a commander-based podcast.
Yeah, that is our sister podcast. Yeah.
Sister brother podcast. Yeah, so you can check that all out, Rocket Jump.
Yep. Beyond that, hopefully we'll be getting a little bit of a special event. We're going to try doing a Mystery Science Theater 3000 like review of the Pro Tour Top 8 when it's airing for Pro Tour Konzatark here.
Yeah. We get to commentate and be buttholes and make mean comments to people that can't hear us.
So mean to the people that aren't in front of us in real life.
And then we're going to record it just to make sure that they can reference it.
Right. All right. Thank you guys, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to the mmcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter @KessWiley and @SecludedGlenn. See you later, alligator.